juniors or for seniors.
Northwestern University, in association with WGN and the Mutual Broadcasting System, presents The Reviewing Stand, now in its 30th year on the air. Tonight's subject, radio's nostalgic yesteryears. To introduce tonight's guests, here is moderator James H. McBurney, Dean of the School of Speech at Northwestern University.
We're very pleased to have you with us as our guest today, gentlemen. Mr. Willard Waterman, radio, television, and stage actor, known best perhaps as the great Gildersleeve, and now touring with a Broadway hit, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
Thank you, Dean.
Mr. James Jewell, president of the Jewell Television Radio Productions and producer of such former radio shows as The Lone Ranger, Green Hornet, Jack Armstrong. And Mr. Franklin McCormick, WGN radio personality and famed producer, writer, director of the Wayne King radio broadcast. Now, as you gentlemen may know, this program, The Reviewing Stand, has survived a number of changes in radio through some 30 years of history on this station, WGN, and the Mutual Network. But the days of programs such as drama, comedy, and so on seem to have passed pretty much into history. Well, I hope later to discuss radio and its functions today as you gentlemen see it. Let's take a little time to think about radio of the past, of the 30s and 40s, and have some fun with it.
In the grand old days of radio.
The grand old days of radio.
Halcyon days of radio.
They were,
is what you call it.
They were the good days.
Somewhere between 1936 and probably 45, there were some 65 five-a-week, 15-minute shows originating in Chicago, network shows, network radio recordings.
Wonderful problems in those days, Willard.
Yes, probably another 30 half-hour shows, such as First Nighter, Grand Hotel, and Chicago Theater of the Air, and many of the dramatic shows.
Where did Gildersleeve get its start, Mr. Waterman?
Well, Gildersleeve originated in the Fibber McGee and Molly show. The character originated there. Don Quinn wrote the character as a character in that show. And then in 1941, the agency involved, which was Needham, Lewis, and Burby, took the character out of the Fibber show and built the show around it for Kraft. And it was on radio from 1941 until 1958.
How long were you with it?
I was with it I took it over in 1950 when Hal Perry left to go to CBS on a CBS contract. And I played it until 1958, during which time I did the television series for one season.
We did. Why don't you bring that character back to us? Say a few words to Leroy.
Well, it wouldn't be too difficult, I guess. You know, my nephew Leroy was a very good boy.
Brings back some very wonderful memories, Dean.
Yeah. Doesn't it, though?
Yes.
A show that that we all know was The Lone Ranger, Mr. Jewell.
Yes.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, there's so many...
That started over in Detroit.
I started in Detroit.
Now, Detroit's was your home base.
My hometown, yes. I started over there as an actor with Jesse Bonstell. Mm. And I left her and started the Jewel Players at WXYZ in 1933. Actually, it was station WGHP, George Harrison Phelps Station, and when George Trendle and John Kunsky, or John King, bought the station, they changed it to WXYZ. And I was at XYZ from 1930 to 38. During that time, we had network programs out of there, but there was the Lone Ranger at 3 a week, and Green Hornet at 2 a week, Challenge of the Yukon, all of these programs came from Detroit.
How did they happen to start in Detroit? What's the explanation of that?
Well, we had a group of showmen over there who'd purchased this station. George Trendle, John Kunsky. John Kunsky owned all of the all of the theaters in Detroit, and they were not satisfied with just a local operation. They knew that the big money was in network programming, and consequently they actually bound together the first few stations of the Mutual Network. We piped the Lone Ranger to Toledo, WTOL, I believe, to New York, to WGN in Chicago, and
it was
one other station.
Sort of basically the beginning of the Mutual Network.
It was. I believe Mutual it was the first program that...
Mutual was, as its name implies, a mutual agreement between a bunch of stations rather than a network headed from the top by owners like NBC and
that's
CBS.
Correct, yes.
Well, what brought you to Chicago?
Well, I left...
Things change in Detroit?
I left XYZ to become program and production manager at WWJ in Detroit. And I was fired from WWJ in Detroit and went to...
Happened to the best of us.
And went to Warner Brothers out on the West Coast. I was out there for 2 years, and Mr. Goebel, E. Ralph Goebel of Goebel Advertising, sent for me and brought me back here to Chicago.
Remember, there were... I can remember it through the years from 1934 until 46 that I was here in Chicago. There were periods of influx from specific towns. There was a time when there were a bunch of people came up from St. Louis. Marvin Miller, who does the Mr. Millionaire, a millionaire on television.
He is, too.
Yeah. But it was one of those things where one, it was like a colony of ants, I guess. One person would come into the into Chicago area, into the network radio, which was basically Chicago at that time, get in and get started and make it make good, and then all of a sudden
you see a regular trail
of ants following him from St. Louis, and then there was another time there was an influx of people from Detroit. Johnny Hodiak.
And Johnny was one of my kids. He started out as a sound effect boy on Lone Ranger.
Yeah, and he came over and did the Dog Patch.
Yes, he auditioned for Winwright on that. Remember Winwright?
Yes.
Winwright was a producer over here in town. He produced a good many very popular shows out of NBC.
Johnny played Little Abner. That's
Little Abner, Abner. Little Abner.
What colony of ants did you follow to Chicago?
Mac? Mac is the father of the ants.
Well, I was in show business like all of the boys here, Jimmy and Willard, and... In 1927, the silent screen started to talk. And by 1929, you couldn't find a theater to work in as a stock company actor. And everything had gone talky. And so the legitimate actor was having a bit of, problem keeping body and soul together.
Coffee and cakes.
And I was living in a broken-down hotel here in Chicago, which... Still going. They have a lot of DPs in it now. But it was known as Actors Paradise, and the actors all lived there, and one of the boys said, you work them? The old man that used to do, what was the Chinese thing? Fu Manchu.
Fu Manchu.
What was his name? The white-haired
Warner
man.
Orland?
No, this
was the Chicago
Before Fire. Oh, yes.
Actor,
Jack
Doty?
Jack Doty. Yeah. No, Jack Daly.
Daly, that's right. Yeah.
I met him in the elevator of this hotel, and he said, how's it going? I said, nothing. No shows going on. I'm getting hungry. He said, there's an audition down here. He said, why don't you come along? I said, what's an audition? And I went with him, and they were doing the lives of famous Americans. Now, this is in 1931. And they were doing the lives of famous Americans, and I didn't know anything about radio except there was something you listened to. And we went up in the Pure Oil building. There was some radio up there. Do you remember that, Willard?
Bob
White, I think, had a studio up there.
Bob White. Yeah. Oh, boy, there's a name for
you. The studio you're referring to.
But I went down there and I read the part, and it was the part of George Washington, and I got it, much to my surprise. I didn't know what I was doing. And after it was over, we didn't, as you do now, you get paid 10 days after you're through with the job, usually. But then we got paid right after the show, and we got paid in cash, and I got $25, and I thought, oh, this is great.
$25? This is, Mac, that was wonderful.
This is great. 30, I mean,
31, that was a big one.
You know, there was no makeup involved. There was no, you read this thing, you didn't have to memorize anything. I thought, well, this is for me, and I've been in it ever since.
You've never failed to stay.
Why, how long have you been in this announcing business?
Well, being, as you know, McBurney and McCormick, there's a little scotch in me. And after being in the role of an actor for a while, and the calls weren't every day, you know, I wanted something that was going to come in every week. So I looked around and I figured the announcer, he was on everything, and he worked every day.
You always got to have an announcer.
You now own the block where that hotel was in, don't you, Mac?
I own all the DPs of it. Those are wonderful days, though, Dean.
I did the first radio show from on WGN from the studios in the Drake Hotel.
I
suppose anybody remembers now that there were studios, GN studios in the Drake Hotel.
I did my first network show out of the Drake Hotel.
That was their only studio.
Shandu the Magician.
Shandu, for heaven's sake.
Well, you went out to this Jack Armstrong show, didn't you?
Yes.
How'd that go?
You mean the opening of the show?
Yeah, how'd it go?
Well, we used to have a series of... four voices. All right, we can all do it. And they were spotted at, different places in the studio. Pat, you better ride the gate. We'll have them knock you off the air with us. But we would have four voices in different parts of the studio, and there would be a progression of the sound. So, you going to do it first, Jim?
Jack Armstrong!
Jack Armstrong!
Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy. And then somebody would come in, wave the flag for Hudson High, boys, show them. I did that for many years. I guess we were talking about it a little while ago, and I thought it was 8, but I guess Jimmy Jewell reminded me that it was 10.
Yeah, I think it was 10 because I was with the show for 8 years, man.
How do you explain the success of these shows? They had an enormous following.
Well, they were almost a way of life in those days. I mean, the soap operas and the kids shows. And I think radio had an impact that I have never known television having. For instance, I remember, I think you probably recall this too, Mac, and possibly you, Jim. Back, this was before I was in Chicago, when Amos and Andy was such a big show, and Andy was having his peccadilloes with Madame Queen. And you go to a motion picture theater, and it's in the Midwest, at any rate, and at 6 o'clock and at 10 o'clock, they take the picture off the screen and play Amos and Andy from a radio set on stage. Because if they didn't, they wouldn't have anybody in the theater. Now, I've never known a television show to have that kind of
Willard,
impact.
I think Willard is right, Dean, that radio in those days was a way of life. It was, I think it filled a necessary void in all of our lives. It was a very important facet to our way of living in those days. And it was, real good entertainment. Radio was very particular in those days, and we had excellent writers, we had excellent directors, and we had something that is also gone. We had excellent actors in those days, because they were fresh out of the theater, and they went from the theater to radio. And where do you get actors today? Where do you find them? They can't act away from here or down to the drinking fountain anymore. They had gone through the hard school of road shows and rep shows and musical comedies and tab shows. And we even had some comics that were out of burlesque. But they were well seasoned, and they knew. And then you had directors, actors, like Jimmy Jewell here, who was an excellent performer in his own right. Then he became a director. And you don't have that today. And I don't think you've had it in the last 10 years.
Well, Mac, don't you think that this also contributes to the success format that Dean was talking about? The fact that this was a period when children had to have a vicarious pleasure that they could not get on the streets. In the old days, of course, without the automobiles, they were allowed to play on the streets, play Indian and cowboy. This is the way I started, by slapping my rump, running down the street, making believe I was galloping along on a horse. But in the days of radio at its highest, the 1930s to 40 or 45, if you're referring to the format of the children's show, Dean,
precisely,
yeah. Precisely. We would give them a vicarious pleasure in a format of All Thunder and No Blood. Now, this was approved by all parents and also all educators. Lone Ranger, for example, never shot a person in all the years he was on the air. He would shoot the gun out of his hand, but he would give them that cowboy urge that I think every man has gone through as a boy, wanting to be a cowboy, and we would allow them to be cowboys. And consequently, we filled a need in their experience, their growing up experience, a need for adventure that they could not get, as they did in my father's time, in your father's time. You had contact then with, in our parents' time, with animals of all kinds, because they were parading through cities, your horses and all the rest of it. But these poor youngsters hardly knew what a horse was. And to ride along with the Lone Ranger and Tonto on a chase of the bad man, and then see him conquer all situations. And we learned early in radio that children, contrary to a general belief, like to see their heroes perfect. They don't like to have their heroes make any mistakes. Now, this is contrary to a good many of the educators' opinions, but nevertheless, on surveys, actual surveys taken in the schoolyards of children, and General Mills made extensive searches in this field, they found out that the children always wanted their heroes perfect. He could do no wrong. This was the format of the Lone Ranger. It was the format of Jack Armstrong and the format of Captain Midnight. All of these heroes were exemplary in every respect. Lone Ranger going into a saloon, he would order a glass of milk. Now,
softy.
He was a softy, but nevertheless, he could turn around and wipe out the bar room. And no one has ever said, found that the milk was spiked in any way.
I think they liked their villains perfect, too, because I remember at one time I was doing Don Winslow, the Navy, and I was playing the Heavy, the Scorpion, who was the arch-villain of them all.
You never changed, did you, Will?
No, he's always been
villain
so
all my life.
He's a mean old man.
But Don, I remember Don Winslow had the Ensign Club, which all the kids joined, and they sent in a box top or something, and he got a Ensign's bars or something. I've forgotten how exactly it was, but anyway... I used to get a lot of mail addressed to the Scorpion saying, we don't want to join Don Winslow's club, we want to join the Scorpion club. So I often wondered whatever came of those kids.
Well, you know, there was another wonderful thing about...
One named Capone? Well, I don't know.
But there was another wonderful thing about the kid shows, Dean. And Jimmy touched on it very lightly, the fact that General Mills, who was one of the sponsors of all of the kid shows, there's a great educational thing. Now, where the action of the play, the story was all fictional, but the locations and the customs of the spot, if we were in Mindanao, the island of Mindanao, or we were down in South America someplace in an episode, there was
a research on it.
Great research done on that. And it was all, that's why, the Mills received many awards from, educational groups. Because it was an educational thing for the kids.
Kids used to come home right after school and pull a chair up to the radio and sit there for probably 2 solid hours.
Well, these kids weren't in it unless they listened, you know.
Yes.
May I make a commentary on just that? Today's radio differs, I think, greatly in this very respect. In those days, not only the children but the adults listened to radio. Today, they merely hear radio with the type of music that is thrown at them all day long and a very meager and inadequate format of news and the top 40 tunes without the variety that we had to stop them, to make them listen. In those days, we had more than just the sameness and the routine that they have today. We had a variety of ideas, a variety of programs. We had conceptions that went along with the trend of the times. Your Amos and Andy trend, your adventure story trend, every phase of show business was represented in radio. And today, today radio doesn't represent any of these powerful listening devices. And I think this is an important thing that we who are in radio and television think about today to revive this business of radio. Maybe I'm getting a little too serious in this.
Well, there was one thing that you said, that the variety was there. For instance, you talk in these kids' shows. I remember one that you may not even remember, Og, Son of Fire.
Oh, yeah.
I
mean,
he was Studebaker.
We were all cavemen, you know, and the kid could go from Jack Armstrong in Mindanao to the caveman era, and then back to Catch Orphan Annie or Don Winslow with the Navy.
Or Tom Mix.
Tom Mix.
Oh, yeah. Tom.
That was another one. I had another fine villain on that. I used to play a character called Diamonds, and he was a guy that weighed supposedly 350 pounds, and he always was eating chocolates. So he'd come out somebody
and say, oh, Tom, I tell you, I ain't going to stand it for you any more at all.
What happened to the dance bands we used to get on radio, Mac?
Well, that is a sad story, Dean. There was a time in Chicago that all of us can remember when every hotel, and we have a great many of them, every hotel had a name band, and you could go into any of the dining rooms, any of the nightclubs, and there was top talent in the way of a good name band. The youngsters in the musicians' world today, they decided they don't want to travel on the road, and the cost of those things has gone up to where when you go into now maybe one of our nice spots and you want to have a nice dinner, it's going to cost you $25, $30, and it's completely out of line. The people just won't pay for it. And then radio doesn't pick up dance bands anymore.
Why not?
It was the early days of radio, and we used to do
the
round-the-town program, and we'd go from one hotel to another with our remote crews.
I remember this very well.
Well, those were the things. There was the value of your advertising, because those bands were heard every night, every night, every night. And so they became names every day.
I noted, I was in the barbershop at the Palmer House getting a haircut the other day, and they told me that Ralph Ginsberg and his Palmer House ensemble has just been canceled.
Yes, they've just closed.
After
just
70 years?
After I don't know how many years, but...
Pat Wyman used to play with that band.
Yeah, but to me, is really an end of an era.
Oh, know? Boy. I'm sorry to hear
you sort of marked that end out at the Aragon here not too long ago.
We ramped that up. They brought Wayne King back, and Wayne was there 30-some years ago, and they brought Wayne back for three nights to close it up, and in three nights they had 18,000 people. Now they got $7.
Never replace Wayne King.
And they got $7.50 a couple. Or if you went in as a single, it was $5. Which only proved to me, and I think it should have proved to those people out there, that if you will give the people what they want, I mean, they'll spend the money and they'll come with you.
Look, gentlemen, our time is up.
Would already? Already?
Would you come back next week and talk some more about radio? This has been, a fascinating discussion. We'd love to have you.
I've enjoyed it.
Good. This has been a Northwestern University Reviewing Stand discussion entitled, Do You Remember Radio? We thank our guest, Mr. Willard Waterman, radio, television, and stage actor, Mr. James Jewell, president of Jewell Radio Television Productions, and Mr. Franklin McCormick, WGN radio personality. This is your moderator, James H. McBurney, Dean of the School of Speech at Northwestern University.
The Reviewing Stand is produced for Northwestern by Robert W. Thomas and directed by Gloria Werkmeister. This is Mutual, a service of the 3M Company.
From across the nation and around the world, when it happens and where it happens, here is the latest news at this hour. Good evening. Doris Bell reporting. For the second time in a month, General of the Army Douglas MacArthur underwent surgery at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington this morning after he developed a severe upper gastrointestinal hemorrhage. The medical center said the second operation was performed at 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time today after MacArthur suffered the hemorrhage and 4 hours of resuscitation were resorted to. The patient withstood the six-hour operation procedure well, the hospital said. Also, actor Peter Lorre, whose gentle manner but sinister voice sent shivers up the spines of moviegoers for 3 decades, died today at the age of 59. Lorre was found dead in the bedroom of his Hollywood apartment by his housekeeper. He apparently suffered a stroke, having been plagued by heart trouble in recent years. Pierre Salinger charged into launching his campaign today for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senator from California, despite legal wrangling on whether he is a bona fide candidate or not. Salinger admitted at a news conference there was a cloud over his candidacy because of the refusal of the San Francisco Registrar of Voters to certify him for the June 2nd primary ballot. However, the affidavit of candidacy was finally accepted. There was a question as to whether the former White House news secretary met residential requirements since he has voted in Virginia for the past 6 years. More news in a moment.
Here's a health tip from the American Medical Association. Arthritis is not a disease that is apt to kill you.
But many of the trials...